It is. It's the weirdest thing how your saliva just like sucks up in there and it's like there's nothing there. I mean, it's just, oh my gosh, fear is just brutal. Brutal. Before I get started, we don't give out chips at roundups, and you may have a clue why, because if we gave out one tonight, tomorrow night, we have a two-hour birthday night that we weren't planning on. And it wouldn't even necessarily be people that had birthdays that day. It would be like, oh, it's today your birthday? No, 3 months ago. But I want to get a chip at the roundup. However, I am up here, and I am married to someone that's celebrating 20 years of sobriety tonight. And that's my husband. So raise your hand. Where are you? This program is just amazing. It's absolutely amazing. I want to get one thing also out of the way very upfront. I was not the speaker the committee selected. Okay? I am a substitute. It's very important that you remember that. I was at the Atlanta Roundup a couple of weeks ago, and the Sunday morning speaker, I'd never heard this, but she says, be careful, folks, because the group gets the speaker that they deserve. I'll know a lot about y'all when I get done tonight. That's right. But it is an honor and a privilege to be asked to do anything in this beautiful program. I have been given the gift of sobriety since April the 5th of 1985, and I am extremely thankful for that. I never intended to stay this long. When I showed up at treatment on a Monday night, I was angry. I was so, so angry about being there. Just, oh my gosh, I was just not a happy camper. Not to mention the fact that I hadn't had a drink in like 3 days, and everybody else that was in detox, they obviously knew they were coming because they were just snockered. I mean, drunk, falling sideways in the chairs, and a few people like reaching for things that weren't there, and I was jealous of them. There's a couple of places in our book that talks about we're normal in every respect except for alcohol, and I can promise you that is not me. I am not normal in anything, really. My mother-in-law taught me to crochet. A month later, I look like Hobby Lobby in my closet upstairs, you know. I mean, I've got yarn for days that I haven't even used, and I still have it. And I have 10 projects or so that I've started, but I haven't completed. But there just always seems to be a better project that comes along that I want to start and not finish. So my husband's from Chicago, and he says, Lord, if I'd have met you at Cubs Stadium and you weren't drinking, I still would have known you were alcoholic. And so I am. I'm one of the, like, really extreme kind of cases. It's funny because, needless to say, women tend to come to me. They're a lot like me. I do get the ones that I don't relate to somewhat, and they do seem kind of normal about some things, although my theory on that is that I just really haven't gotten to know them quite as well yet as I'm going to. I did not say your name. Look, this is just the most amazing, amazing program because I happen to be of the theory that, I don't know, if I'm any less alcoholic, maybe I just find a way to not need you as much. Or maybe I'm able to come to just a barely a few meetings and it be sufficient. Or maybe I'm not in this life and death. I know that it's life and death for me, and, you know, I just can't take any more calls from anybody. You know, I've got a life now. AA gave me this amazing life. I'm supposed to be out here doing life. And that's true. AA has given me a life frankly, they've given me a life that I never thought I wanted, really. You know, I mean, this wouldn't, what I have is not what I would have written down at age 20 when I got here saying, wow, this is what I want, you know, be a stay-at-home mom. And it just to be able to truly be a wife, to give, to care about, to put my child's needs ahead of my own. And I can tell you, I didn't always do that even one day at a time coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I grew up in East Texas, a little small town. It always seemed to me that it was much more important how people perceived that you were doing in your home, not how you actually were. You know, we come to the Al-Anon speaker meeting tomorrow. You know, I went to a few conferences before I knew that I was actually allowed to come to the Al-Anon speaker meeting. I don't know why I thought I wasn't, except that I didn't go to Al-Anon. And I'm telling you, I learned about the disease of alcoholism and how it affects families. And I really came to realize that I grew up in a home where I had a mom and dad that were married almost 56 years when my dad passed. He worked for the same company for 42 years. We were at church Sunday morning, went home for lunch and a little nap or football, came back at 5 o'clock or something for GAs, and then, you know, service, and then Wednesdays we had church service, and then we had adult choir, and I mean, it was just a lot of work, and we were there constantly. And look, I'm not going to still stand up here and tell you that I came from a bad family, but what I do know is that I came from a family that had been affected by alcoholism. My mom's mom and dad both were alcoholics. You know, my mom, I used to say she never touched a drop of alcohol, but I used to always say that I thought if she did, she would have drank a lot of it. And she actually said to me one day that, she said, yes, I had a sip of port. Wine, some sort, I think. And she said, I knew I never needed to do that again because it was really good. And I thought, I knew it. My dad, his siblings, chock full of alcoholics. I don't think my dad ever take a sip of alcohol. I'm not sure he wouldn't have liked it a whole lot, too, because my dad was the other person in our home that didn't know how to deal with his emotions at all. And so when he got emotional about anything, which usually meant angry, he disconnected completely with us. He didn't speak to us. He didn't acknowledge our presence. And that could go on for days or it could go on for weeks. You know, and it's a really tough thing when you are a daddy's girl. You love your daddy just more than you can even say. And yet there's this turmoil in me that I didn't know what it was. In regards to him and like, if he really loves me, and I know I love him like so much, how can he just not even act like I'm here, you know? And so it was this struggle. But again, I don't really ignore that. I mean, I ignore that, and I just, whenever he starts talking to us again, we're like, oh, thank goodness. Nobody goes, why weren't you talking to us for a couple of weeks? We don't do that because that could send us into another 2 weeks without him speaking to us again, you know? And I mean, that's exactly the stories I hear people talk about where alcoholism, you know, dad's drunk, throws the food off the table, says go to bed at 5 o'clock, and the next morning, you know, their kids are getting out of bed, and they're like, and dad's going, hey, kids, how are y'all? How are y'all? We don't go, oh, dad, why'd you throw that food away last night? Because it just, it's not good. And, you know, and their dads were drinking all the time. But again, I had everything that certainly I needed. I had most of what I wanted. My brother and sister were 15 and 17 years older than me, and so I pretty much was raised as an only child. And what I know is that I always felt like I needed to be around older people. I was never quite sure why. My mom used to tell me that I had an old soul. And it's kind of true in the sense that long before I ever got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean, people would come to me and talk to me about their problems. I mean, like my boyfriend's mother's telling me things I really did not need to know. I can tell you that. You know, and yet there just always seemed to be a comfort level that people would have in sharing their stories with me. And you know, I look back on it, and I really gave some fantastic advice. I mean, I did. And, I was really always kind of impressed with that, really. And all, but when it came to myself, which is still as true today as it ever was, I can't see myself objectively. 29 years sober, I can't see myself objectively. To this day, I still have to have sponsorship. You know, my sponsor, Naomi, she's been my sponsor for a long time, over 22 years of my sobriety. And she's been terminal for forever, okay? I mean, the doctors are like, we have no idea why you're still here. And all of us girls that she sponsored were like, we do. You know, hopefully God's given me a little time to scope things out a little bit or whatever. But, I mean, it's like I have to still have that to this day. Have to. You know, tell me how my relationship with my sponsor's going. Tell you how often I'm calling, how much we're talking, and I can pretty much lay out all the rest of the relationships in my life, and it'll look a lot like how my one with my sponsor's going. I mean, and that's just the truth. I had my first drink at 12. It was the greatest thing that ever happened to me in my whole life. It was warm beer, which, and let me say, I never liked cold beer, later, but, so it was the most disgusting thing I'd ever put in my mouth. It was like, there was this inward thing, though, going, you can do it, and if you do it, it's going to be great, and I don't know how I thought I knew that, but it was like, just push through it, it's horrible, but just push through it, and sure enough, I mean, the most amazing thing happened for me, and, I'm a blackout drinker. It happened for my very first drink. So I thought that happened to everybody. You know, I didn't know that alcohol didn't do for other people what it did for me is just the bottom line. I didn't know that. I still don't really know what it does for you, really. It was funny. I was talking to Doug. I'm like, what is alcohol? You know, when you go to an open bar party, how many do you have? You know, because we were talking like, oh man, I wouldn't have a bar party. Can you imagine what that bill would be? And I'm like, yeah, but I don't think they drink like we do, so it might not be as expensive as we think, you know. You know, and I was kind of proud because at first he goes, oh, well, he says, you know, I can have five or six, and it's like, oh, rock on, awesome. And he goes, but a lot of times I don't have any. I don't have to have any. I'm sorry. I'm just so sorry. That I mean, it's like I cannot imagine. I can't imagine what I just, it's like all I know is what it did for me, and it wasn't just about doing something to me. I mean, it did amazing things for me. And here's really the crux of it. It made me breathe. In the doctor's opinion, oh my gosh, if you're new and this whole powerless, unmanageable thing, what that's all about, read the doctor's opinion in our book, because it is a beautiful description. It was written by a doctor back in the 30s, and he worked with us. I mean, before AA came into existence, this man was trying to do everything he knew to help people that were alcoholics, and he just absolutely was like, I don't know what to do. I don't understand this. I don't know what's going on. And he was one of the main leading contributors for us from a medical perspective to understand about this is a disease. It's an illness. But it talks about the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. And that's exactly what it did for me. It also talks about that there's this phenomenon of craving coupled with an obsession of the mind. The beautiful part about that is that if you don't put the alcohol in, you don't set off the phenomenon of craving. But you still got this nasty, obsessive mind. But I don't know any of that. All I know is that, man, I am going to do that again every time I can get a chance to do that again. Because that was amazing. And so, I mean, at that point, I'm 12. And, I mean, the planning it was almost as fun as the drinking it. I mean, I'm telling you, from that first drunk, every thought was about not getting in trouble at home, keeping my room picked up. Ooh, don't throw all that stuff under the bed. Mom will find it. She'll ground you. Who's going to buy it? At 12, you got to work hard. Who's going to buy it for us? Where are we going to meet up? You know, I mean, there are a lot of details that have to be covered. And so, you know, it was like, I mean, that was like a whole week's worth of stuff, you know? I mean, so by the time that Friday came, I mean, believe me, I am not organized as much area of my life. It's so funny because people that have known me since I've been here, they're like, oh my gosh, you're so organized. And my husband like falls out of his chair like, seriously? No, she's not. It's like, what are you talking about? But what it is that I've learned some skills. Again, I had to learn how to be organized from people in the rooms and his sister. You know, it's like teaching me how to, like have like all these little clear pull drawer thingies with little labels. Of course, I get obsessed on that then, right? And I am more concerned about what the labels look like than putting the stuff in the little drawer, you know? But it's like, but let me tell you something. When it came to organizing the weekend that had to do with drinking, I'm on top of that. I'm on top of that. Because it's like I just cannot wait. I didn't get into a tremendous amount of trouble while I was in school. I think largely due to the fact that I didn't know until I was a senior in high school that you could drink on a Tuesday. It never occurred to me to drink on a Tuesday. And when I found out that you could, like I said, it's probably just as well I didn't find that out for a while. And I, you know, somehow I still managed to graduate high school. I went to college. In fact, I got there a month early. And I still to this day wonder how I pulled that off with my parents, letting me go a month early. Of course, I knew why I was going a month early, but I'm not sure why she thought I was going a month early. But I got down there, and, I mean, it was just party central. I mean, holy cow, it was the first time in my whole entire life that I didn't have, like, curfews or somebody that, you know, was checking things out. And it was like all of a sudden I had all this freedom. And let me tell you, I had a blast. It was just amazing. I didn't go to school much. I honest to God, don't. I would have to go back and look at my transcript. Very little did I get credit for. Very, very little. I know at some point I was going to school. I know at some point I wasn't going to school, but I was still in the dorm. At some point, I stopped going to school, and I moved in with a friend of mine that had a house. And then at some point, I started cocktail waitressing, which led to bartending, which led to me living on a bunch of your couches, probably. I mean, a lot of people's couches. I was that guy, that person that showed up. It's like, hey, can I hang out? You know, and I would bring whatever few of the items that I had, and I still, it would be a few, but I probably still left two with you when I left, you know? I mean, because slowly but surely, somehow I ended up in an apartment all by myself, and there wasn't one stick of furniture in that apartment, you know? And I mean, I'm drinking. By this time, I'm drinking every single day. I'm bartending at a Mexican restaurant. I got to be there at 10:30 in the morning, and I start drinking from the moment that I get there. And I don't stop until 2-3 o'clock in the morning. I go home. I pass out. I get up. I get to work because I am going to be on time for work. 10:30, get to work so I can have my first drink so that I can then do that all over again. And I did that every day for almost 2 years. I got a DWI somewhere in there. It did not slow down my drinking. It just slowed down my driving for a couple of weeks. I left my car at the bar, and I got a call from the bar saying, Tracy, you got to get your car, babe, or we're going to have to tow it. And so I went and got my car, and, well, I'm back to drinking and driving because, I mean, what else was I supposed to do? You know, I mean, I had to get my car back. But I got that first, you know, I mean, it didn't even slow me down. I went to see a probation officer, and she asked me a lot of questions about my drinking. You know, do you drink at parties? Yep. Do you drink, you know, when you go out to eat dinner? Well, I don't do that much. You know, I work in a Mexican restaurant, so I don't go out to eat much. But, yeah, I mean, if I did, I would. And, you know, do you drink, like, at social occasions? Drinking is a social occasion. And she's like, no, but I mean, like, if you were to go bowling, you know, would you drink? Oh, definitely. Do you drink by yourself? No, wait, hang on just 1 second. Now, that I don't care for at all. You know, I'm a people person. You know, I'm really social, and I like to be around people, but if there just wasn't anybody there, yeah, I would. And I have no idea that I need to be lying. I mean, because I don't even know that there is a problem with this. I know that I'm not living the life that my parents live, but who would want to, right? And so I just, it's like, well, of course. And then she asked me this very next question, and I'm going to tell you this 6 weeks before I got to you. She said, do you think that you have a problem with alcohol? And I answered that question just as honestly as I had all the others, and I said, absolutely not. Anybody that ever said that to me, I knew they didn't get it. I don't know why they didn't get it. I figured the reason they didn't get it is because they weren't drinking. But turns out, no, they could actually be drinking and still not get it. But I mean, it's like this internal thing that I knew that they did not get it. They did not understand. My mom called me one day and told me that my dad was on his way to bring me my bed. And I'm in this apartment. I'm drunk, of course, and so I go home and pass out. It's a two-hour drive. Like, I think I'm going to pass out come to in 2 hours. But I went home to wait for him there. The banging on the door roused me. I opened the door. He's not speaking to me. we go to the car. I get the bed. We bring it in. I know that knowing my dad, he probably set it up for me. There's not one word uttered in this exchange. He goes to open the door to leave, and he turns around, and I can only see one side of his face, but I see this steady flow of tears. He shuts that door, and I stand there and think to myself, what's your problem? What's your problem? Granted, maybe I'm not living the life that you would have me live, but you know what? Hey, I am like over 2 hours from your house. You know, anything like under an hour or sometimes even like a little over an hour, it still seemed to be able to travel back to the little small town, right? But if you got like a good 2 hours away, you were pretty safe. And all I'm thinking about that he really cares about is that, you know, at least the people in town don't know that what I'm doing. So your precious reputation that stays intact. That's what I'm thinking standing there. My last 6 weeks of my drinking and that occurrence with my dad coming to that apartment, I had no memory of any of that until I was over 5 years of sobriety. And what my dad walked into that day was an apartment where there wasn't one stick of furniture, where there were black pants and white shirts. I mean, that's pretty much what my wardrobe had come down to at the bartending. There was no electricity in that apartment. I stop and think today, and especially with the fact that I've got a son, that is an admitted alcoholic and drug addict. And, can I ever say with all certainty that he's just hurting himself, not anybody else. That's where I was. I ended up moving home not long after that. A bunch of friends of mine were getting in trouble, and a lot of trouble, and it scared me. It was the first time I'd really been scared in my drinking, and I moved back in with my parents, and I made a decision, you know, if I'm going to live with them, I can't drink. How alcoholic is that? And I don't even know it. I mean, I don't know about the phenomenon of craving that happens once I take it into my system. I don't know about the sense of ease and comfort that comes and that I have to have more. There's not a choice in this. I am going to have more. I don't know anything about that. And yet my mind says you need to not drink, and I didn't for a month. And here's what I know about alcoholism versus the hard drinker. The hard drinker, he gets into some trouble. And he may drink a lot. He may even really resemble us. But when he stops drinking, and he may even have to do some detoxing, but when he stops drinking, his problems stop. They get better. Girlfriend says, you know, me or the drink? Oh, well, okay. Puts the drink down and go on to be in this relationship. Or, man, your health's not good. You know, you're really drinking too much. You need to stop, or, you know, your health's just going to be really, really bad. Well, all right. And they get healthy and just move on along. Me, I'm an alcoholic. So when I stop drinking, this is when my problems begin. I mean, this is when I cannot stand still. I cannot stand the feel of me in my own skin. I can't stand it. And so, you know, even to this day, my husband and I were laughing about this the other day. It's like, you know, let me tell you, I could be really busy. I mean, I could be a busy little bee. Doesn't mean I am productive by any stretch of the imagination, but I can be very busy. And busy is what I was for that 30 days. The whole time, patting myself on the back, hanging out with my friends in the bar, you know, hey, you want a drink? No, I'm not drinking. Oh, that is so great. Yeah, it sure is. Dang it. Great, we're having a great time. And then a friend of mine asked me to come help her move. I've done that a lot, so I was certainly willing to be helpful to her. She held up a half-gallon bottle, had about this much alcohol in it, and she said, let's have a drink. And I said, I'm not having any. And she said, I know, and I'm so proud of you, but look, there's only enough in here for us to each have one drink apiece. That's it. And I tell you that because it was my one and only time that I really meant to have one. I had that drink. I came out of a blackout in my car on the grass on the side of the road, facing the wrong way for the side of the road that I'm on. Does it occur to me even one little bit what happened? How did I get here? Did I hit anything or anybody? Absolutely not. That did not cross my mind whatsoever. All I was aware of was the fact that I had spilt my drink, and I was livid about it. And but then it's like as soon as that oh my gosh, then the panic, not even really panic, like terror sets in because I don't know if I have enough change to get that next drink. And so that frantic search begins looking for it. And I'm here to tell you that when you just find enough change to get the next drink, you can get that sense of ease and comfort because I know it's coming. And I was to drink from that moment through the next 6 weeks without taking a breath. And I got to tell you, I can't tell you how much my life had to be out of control for that to be happening because I'm living in my parents' house and I don't even care that they know. I don't care. And I got picked up for my second DWI. Of course, my parents didn't know about the first one. And I didn't know that when you're supposed to go see somebody like probation officers, that you're like supposed to go back often, like monthly. You know, I had gone and answered my questions, so I was done. Turns out they were looking for me, and I just didn't even know. And so it's like I got arrested, and it was like that night I was in there, and I just kept thinking that, what is the matter with me? Why do I keep ending up here? I mean, when I started drinking, I didn't take a drink and go, you know what? This drink is going to be worth my self-respect. This drink is going to be worth just blowing that opportunity at the education that your parents really had set out for you and allowed for you to be able to do. I didn't know that just one drink at a time that it's like I'm just giving away pieces of me and of my soul. I didn't know. But what I did know was on that floor of that jail, I just did not know. How had I gotten here? How had I? Because, again, that last 6 weeks, I'm drinking in the car in a parking lot. No more bars, no more friends, no more dancing on the tables. I'm sitting in my car, and, of course, I drive to a really bad area of town so that I can feel better about myself. These people out here, they were really bad, you know, so I sit there with my bottle in my car, and it's like, oh, yeah, I'm doing good, a lot better than them, and God, the arrogance, it's just mind-numbing, and you know what, that drunk, that DWI was my last drink. Had no idea it was going to be my last drink. I already told you that. My mom was going to drive me to school on Monday morning because I couldn't see where she wasn't going to let me have my car, and she actually thought I was still going to school. And we got there, and I'm going to tell you what happened next had nothing to do with me at all. All of a sudden, I heard myself say to my mother, if I get out of this car, I'm going to drink. It was like an outer body kind of a thing because I'm like looking down at myself going, what you doing? Get out of the car. But what's happening is that I'm telling my mom I can't get out of this car or I'll drink. And she drove us to this payphone. It had a phone in it and a phone book. And she looked to the P's and found psychiatrist, psychologist, something. And we drove straight there. And by 6 o'clock that night, I'm sitting in the detox ward of PNS Hospital in Shreveport, Louisiana. It took us that long to get there because we had to go shopping. I mean, I had to look good in treatment, you know. It's all about perception, right? And I did, too. She bought me pantyhose and slips and everything. And what's insane is I wore it. Didn't take me long, though. I was a fantastic treatment patient. I mean, it was like people were like, what are you doing here? I mean, you like seem like you have your act all together. And, you know, are you here visiting someone? And it was like, well, immediately I knew God needs me here for these people. I mean, people have come to me my whole life, talking to me, asking me about my problems or their problems and what can they do. And it was like, and I settled right in. My counselor, I think back and it's like, what a dum-dum. Because he was like, wow, you're going to be a really great counselor one day. Well, one day. I mean, doing a pretty good job of it right now. And more people want to come talk to me than to you, you know. And treatment was great. I mean, I was just an idiot, but it was great. I had some withdrawal. I honestly thought for a long time that I got the flu. Isn't that ridiculous? I thought I got the flu, and I was, I mean, but literally it's like I couldn't hold anything down. I had no idea that that's the shape I'm in. I had no idea, really. I didn't know, and I got out of there, but the beautiful thing that happened to me while I was there is a lot of people came in and stood behind one of these, and they told their stories. And, you know, there's a lot of times, and sometimes even me, it's like I like to get up here and think, all right, well, I'm just going to talk, you know, just 2 seconds about the drinking, and because I want to move on into the sobriety, because believe me, it's really much more ridiculous. But the truth of the matter is that the identification, it is the biggest gift that we can give. It is the most important thing. And it's the thing that has to happen with every new person that comes in. Because if there is not the identification, then we do not have a solution for them. Which don't. They have got to identify. And, you know, but people came and they stood behind this podium and there was just something about them that I wanted. They were all from the same home group. And I'm telling you, it's like I got out of there and I did a couple of months in a halfway house, but then I got an apartment. And you know how I went searching for an apartment was what apartment complex is closest to that church where they hold their meeting at? That's the impact that they had on me. I hadn't even had a conversation with any of them yet, and that's the impact that they had. And I started going there and I got a sponsor and she put me at the door greeting, and at 6 months sober, got coffee. Oh, it's a big deal when you get coffee. It's not really maybe as much of a big deal now, but people didn't come into the meetings already having coffee in their hands. They got it when they got there. You know, it was like I was so godly that I'm rocking. They know I've got this thing. And really what I look back on is it's like they just kind of gave me that, you know, old-timer nod and, yeah, keep coming back. We love you, you know. Come on. And this is really genius when I stop and think back about it. And how they used my enthusiasm and my love for wanting to help other people to keep me here long enough that when the pain hit, I had a lot more to lose than what I would have. I had you. They made it important, and they invited me out to after every single meeting. We would go somewhere, and I didn't have money, but sometimes I had a glass of water, and sometimes a piece of pie would show up in front of me, and sometimes an entire meal showed up in front of me. And I didn't know where they came from. Nobody would say. They just show up, and they invited me into their homes. It's like there was a lot of people not inviting me into their homes. And it was amazing to me. I felt like the red carpet had been rolled out for me. That's how I felt. And I know that I've met some of you at the meetings, and my husband and I moved here a little over a year ago. And it's like I am who I am, and it's so important to me to greet everybody at that meeting and to say hello. And here's my number, but can I get yours? Because you know what? It's easier for me to pick up the phone than it is for them. Am I going to call them every single day? Am I going to do that? No, I'm not going to do it every day, but you know what? It seems to somehow make it a little easier for them to call me once I've called them. It's just amazing. And so it's like, it's not some big, oh, I'm so great or whatever. It's like, these people, that's what they gave me. They remembered my name. Right before I was coming up here, this guy, and he's right, I keep forgetting. I don't know why I'm having such a hard time with his name. I think he's been sober too long. But he's like, oh, yeah, I'm the one that you never remember my name. It's like, oh, thanks. Good dose of humility before I come up here. You know, but it's like, in all honesty, it's more important for me to remember the people that are newer. I'm more worried about their names. I'll eventually get it. I'll get them. But it's like, because I can't tell you what that did to me. I mean, I would have given my life for these people. That's the impact that they had on me. And I had a sponsor, and I worked steps. And but like I said, more than anything, it was just about coming in and getting a foothold. I did my fifth step at probably about 9 months of sobriety, and I went over everything that I was aware of, and but the emotions really hadn't come yet. And I said, did I do something wrong? And she said, no, baby, just keep coming. They'll come. And they did, like really harshly. But again, see, if I don't have what I have with you when they come, I've got nothing to lose by drinking. Yeah, maybe my life or whatever, but if I don't have any ties, if I'm not connected in with people, I leave. And but there was too much to lose. Now, while I was in treatment, I met this guy, and I married him at 15 months of sobriety, and I don't recommend that to anybody. I am not one of those people that it's like, oh, let me get her as a sponsor. She did that, so she'll be okay with that. Nope, nope. I'm one of those people that did that and went, heck no, we're not doing that. Because that's really stupid. And and here's why it's stupid. Because I have no idea who I am. I think I do. Oh, this is all great, and I'm helping people, and it's great and wonderful. And here's what I know today. He needed somebody to take care of him, and I needed somebody to take care of. Made me feel good to take care of him, and he still needs to be taken care of. He ended up buying a house or building a house on his mama's backyard. Okay, so, but I remember because it's like I was 6 months. We were married 6 months. I got pregnant. At 5 months pregnant, he calls me, tell me he's been shooting dope for 6 weeks. The relationship's over right there. You know, hurt me once, shame on you. Hurt me twice, shame on me. And so now I stayed in it. We had Aaron, and it took me six months to get him out of the house. It's very important who leaves, you know, as far as how people are going to judge the situation. And but I had a date that night, Okay, well, if you're going to push it, let me just say that he actually tried to come back, my husband, right? He's like, oh, I think I've changed my mind. Right? I am walking out the door. You know, it's like, oh, no, uh-uh. Took me 6 months to get you out of this house. You are not stepping 1 foot back in this house, you know. And so that next 2.5 years was some of the most insane period of my entire sobriety. In and out of a relationship that was probably the sickest relationship I have been in my entire life. I have met some amazing men in this program, and I have also met some extremely sick ones. Let me qualify it and say, though, that if anybody ever tried to prove the premise that healthy can choose sick, I tried. I mean, I really wanted that to be the truth, but you can't. You can't because you're not even attracted to it. Doug laughs all the time. He's like, yeah, she got well when she met me, you know. And the truth of the matter is he wouldn't have even noticed me who I was then. He wouldn't have. Because, again, you attract what you are or what you need. And you've got to stop needing something to be able to just want it. And 2.5 years, and I'm telling you, I wanted to die. For 2 years, I'm coming to meetings one day at a time, dying in AA, and I mean, really, really wanted to die. And all of a sudden, when I was 15, I was at this church that I grew up in, and there was a guy that came in one Sunday morning, and he had lots of guns, and he started shooting, and he said, this is war, and he just started plowing the bullets through the sanctuary, and there were 5 people that were killed that morning. One of them was a 7-year-old little girl named Gina Lynam, and I had babysat her and her brother and sister the summer before, and they were like my kids. And it wasn't even that tragedy that caused me to have issue with God. It's like, man, it was the most amazing thing, and it's really a lot like AA. You know, when you really are struggling and you're in the middle of this thing, I'm telling you, you will not believe what people will do for you. What they've done for me. But 22 months later, he got finally back to Dangerfield to get ready to stand trial, and a lady was going to see him every day, and one day came out and said, praise God, he's been saved, and he's going to heaven. And I was like, you know what? Because I'd been taught that if what she said had happened, then he was going to heaven. And it's like we agnostic talks about, you know, this God of logic and reason. And it's like trying to figure it out in my head. And if I can't figure it out in my head, then it's not right. And I just could not get there of how does God let this guy in to heaven where I know Gina is. I mean, and I couldn't get there. And you know, at that point, I had started doing some drinking again after the shooting, and it was like I was just too tired to bother. Now, I kept going to church and doing all the things I'd been doing because that was just a requirement to live in my parents' house. But everything changed inwardly for me because it was like, you know what? I'm done with you. That didn't cause me any fear, no nothing. And I didn't think it even caused me any issues. Yes, I saw the steps on the wall. Yes, I thought that might be a little problematic, but I won't, you know, I'm just not going to worry about it right now. And again, my sponsor had me building relationships, and I'm like, I don't know about this whole God thing. I don't think I can work the steps. And it was like God again put somebody perfect in my life and said, look, step one says you got two problems. You got problems when you drink, and you have problems when you don't drink. Step two says there's a solution to your two problems. Step three says, do I want the solution to my two problems? Do I want it? And if so, step four. And that's literally how I got through to my first five steps in this program. It had nothing to do with having a relationship with God. It had everything to do with having a relationship with you. God, group of drunks that gave me good, orderly direction. That you were my higher power. But all of a sudden, one day, I'd come to meetings and I wasn't feeling any better anymore. You know, it was like magic for a long time. Or I'd call my sponsor and I'd get off the phone and be like, oh, yes. Now, I probably didn't do a thing she told me to do afterwards. But, I mean, if you get massive relief from just talking about it, I am not big into extra credit work. I can tell you that. And, no. And so, I mean, if that's what gives me relief, then guess what? I don't do anything else until I'm dying. Until I'm on my stomach. I'm not even on my knees. I am on my stomach, groveling on my floor. And the pain finally outweighed my head. And when it outweighed my head, he's not going to want you. He's not going to help you. You walked away from it. You know, you don't deserve his help. As long as that was louder than what was in here, I could not take that step to be open to God. But when the pain got so horrible and I'm on my knees, all of a sudden, that pain, it was just enough pain to outweigh my head. And I'm telling you, I did not think these words. It was like they came from my insides of God, help me. And he did. My sponsor, about that time, got a new sponsor. I don't know if that's ever happened to you. Wow, does a bunch of stuff start sliding downhill. You know, they're getting like all this new improved information or new way to look at it. Boom, here it starts coming to you. But the timing was great because I was like, okay, God, whatever. And I'm telling you, it's like I did things that I hadn't had the willingness to do or whatever. And it was like, I'm telling you, my life started changing amazingly. Unfortunately, I didn't like hand all the areas of my life over quite yet. I did some. And believe me, in Weagnostics, again, it's a chapter that is so dear to me because that night when I uttered those words of God help me, it's like I picked up this book, and I'm telling you, it probably still cracked at that point. But I picked it up and I literally opened it right to We Agnostics, where it talks about that all we have to do is just seek God. We just have to try. We don't even have to necessarily believe a certain thing. All it's really asking of us is, am I willing to believe that there is a power greater than myself? And if not, am I willing to pray to be willing to believe that there's a power greater than myself? I mean, that is just, it's ridiculous because you can still go, yeah, I don't really think so. But you can still move on because all you got to, it's like, well, are you willing to just pray for the willingness to come? Well, yeah, I guess so. Woo! You know, we're excited because we know. I'm sorry, that stuff out of my nose, I thought it was going to hit the front row there. Thank y'all for laughing so I could, like, blow all that out. I'm so sorry, honey. I'm so sorry. But everything changed. And yet, a man walked into the group. He was new. And he was cute. And he had a Texas plate on his car. And because I was a member at Rebos over in Marietta for, like, 6.5 years. I lived here way back. If you were there, I'm so sorry. Please come talk to me afterwards. I was a part of the problem, not the solution, but I was very enthusiastic about it. And he walked in, and it was like, oh, God gave me this. And, you know, my sponsor that I have now, she tells me, she says, look, you know, if you ever are, like, kind of scanning the room and your eyes meet somebody's, and it's like all of a sudden your heart just starts beating really, really fast, and she said, run. Turn and run as fast as you can, because that is not love, that is lust. You know, because, I mean, I think that means something, you know, and I think it's love or whatever. And I married him in 6 months. I know to this date, I know, here's the thing I didn't know then. It takes 6 to 9 months of dating before you actually are going to see who the true person is. It's going to take you that long to see who the true person is of me, too. It's not that I'm consciously trying not to be honest about who I am, but you put on your little niceties a little bit, you know. And you want to go bowling? I hate bowling. Sure. And then we get in a huge fight after we're married of, I am not going bowling any longer, you know. It's like, you love bowling. No, I did not. I never did. And it's like, then why did we go? I would have been fine without going. Oh. I mean, because, you know, I want you to like me. I don't want you to get upset at me or whatever, and I'm dishonest. I'm dishonest. And let me tell you, that relationship was insane, just pure insanity. Again, we moved from here to North Carolina for 6 months, back to East Texas for 6 months, Sheldon, Missouri for 2 months, back and then to the Dallas-Fort Worth area, where I've spent a little over the last 22 and a half years of my sobriety before coming here. And at almost 10 years of sobriety, I'm living in a tent. It's really what happens when you don't have the money to pay. I was working a lot of hours. I was doing the best that I could trying to get money to be able to pay for our bills, but it's like money was getting spent on things that it never should have, and it's like we ended up in a tent. And look, there were people in the program that offered me a place to stay. They offered myself and my son a place, but they didn't want him there too. They didn't invite him. And I got to stay with my husband. Oh, and these really crazy sick relationships, that son of mine, see, again, I have this whole idea that, you know, so what if I, you know, mess up, or so what if this isn't maybe the perfect guy, or, you know, I mean, if I'm hurting anybody, you know, I'm only hurting myself, right? Again, back to that. Like, my actions and these men's lives that I keep dragging my son through, like, it has no bearing on his life whatsoever. None. That's what my actions said. And, We ended up living in a tent. I'm here to tell you, you can stay sober and live in a tent. We lived there for like 6 weeks. I felt very blessed in the state of Texas. If you're going to camp, the best time to do it is like in the spring. It's very hot later. And so I ended up homeless living in a tent in April. I mean, I was like, thank you, God. I mean, you know, that's great. And I got up every day and still went to work. I was working and he wasn't. And here's the little jewel that God gave my son. My son loves to fish. His school teacher called me out one day and she goes, are y'all on vacation? Your son seems to think y'all are on vacation. And yes, we are. We are on vacation. And a guy that I didn't know, somebody said, I think he's leasing his house, and I went and saw him, and he goes, I have no idea where you got that information, but no, I wouldn't plan to lease my house. And but, you know, I've heard your story, and 72 hours later, he moved all of his belongings out of his house. He wasn't in the program. He moved all his belongings out, put them in storage, and went to go live with his mom. 2 weeks after we're in there, I'm like, why did you do that? And he said, just seemed like you needed it more than I did. But I'd gotten back really, really active in the program. I was still struggling. In fact, I told my sponsor when I was at the tent, I need to let go of all these sponsees I have. It's ridiculous. You know, you can't sponsor somebody living in a tent. And she goes, well, you're not going to do that because you have a pager and there is a payphone. Back to that payphone thing. There is a payphone out at the camp. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. And she said, nope. And I did it. I'd get paged, and you've got to love the brand new person, because the self-centeredness knows no bounds. So they're paging their sponsor for me to call them back from the camp. And is there one? How's it going out at the camp? No, not one. My boyfriend's being ugly to me. It's like, what I'm thinking is, oh yeah, that nice apartment you got? Mm-hmm. Air conditioning? Mm. Really, baby? I'm so sorry. Let's get our book out. After that first phone call, the one most important factor I became aware of, and that's I needed to bring a lawn chair to the payphone. But I'm just going to give you a little fair warning, because that's the kind of sponsorship I've had from the very beginning. So when I say, hey, I need some help, or somebody needs some help, or I got a 12-step call, or hey, this person, you know, man, we need to go pick them up and get them and take them, get a cup of coffee, or, you know, hey, we got a phone call, and, you know, something's needed over here, or whatever. It's like, don't tell me, oh, I'm just not in the best of all places right now. I'm going to go, tent. And if there was ever a time that you needed to be doing it, it's at that time. It saved my life. I'm telling you, it saved my life. Finally, thank goodness, he had an affair with a girl I sponsored. That's not how I felt about it at the time, but it was later. And I was a little angry at the moment. But 6 months later of, like, doing everything my sponsor told me to do, I'm telling you, I knew a new freedom and a new happiness that I'd never known in the entirety of my being in AA. For the first time, if it was just me and my son for the rest of my days, I was all right with that. I had some serious amends to go back and make to that child. He was 9 years old, and I remember saying to my sponsor, you know, do I go to him at this age? Do I talk to him? And she said, absolutely. And she sat down with me, and she wrote out every word that I was to say and how I was to say it. And these steps are powerful. In the foreword of the 12 and 12, it says that these steps are a group of principles, spiritual in nature, which if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. That's the power. My son did have problems with alcohol and with drugs and arrested constantly. And again, y'all were with me. When he got arrested the first time as a big boy, you know, 17, going like to the real deal, one of you came to my house and picked me up and took me to see him because you knew I wouldn't be able to drive home. And I wasn't. When over and over, God, oh my gosh, I should get him out. Nope, I said I wouldn't. I said I wouldn't. Mean what you say. Say what you mean. You can't do this, Tracy. You have got to stick to your word. You have got to do, for the first time in your life, this child has got to know that you meant it. But if I had still been living in guilt, I would have had to have gone and gotten him. Because it's my fault you're there. And it wasn't. I had let go of that. You know, I still have to have help from God in knowing how to love my son. But again, the day that he got sentenced to prison, I'm there. I'm in the courtroom. He gave me this beautiful granddaughter. The day she was born, he was holding her, and I thought, oh my gosh. I mean, I could feel the love. I was like, I could see it and feel it and touch it. And 8 months later, he and her are shooting heroin and putting the baby to bed in the crib and leaving the apartment, leaving her there alone by herself. That's this disease. I went through real struggles with hating him because of what he was doing to her. But again, this program, it comes through. Fair weather or foul, it is the solution to all of my problems. It's right here. When I got willing to be alone for the rest of my life, God put Doug in my life. We served. I was GSR. He was at the area assembly. And don't tell me that service work does not pay, because I'm telling you. There's good ones at the service assembly. So, you know, hey, if you get your act sober and start working steps and get all that stuff done, go hang out at the area assemblies. You become GSR of your group, and then you go, and then there's some really cool men there, or women. And, you know, I don't have time to get into, there's so many details. What I can tell you is that I made a list of what I wanted in a man. My sponsor said, I want you to write down every single thing. And I did. And I got every single thing. The only thing that was not on my list that he didn't have right away was a motorcycle. Because I kind of like motorcycles. And he did not have a motorcycle, but I'm telling you, he got one just as soon as he could. I did not even know he was like a motorcycle boy. You know, vroom, vroom. I didn't even know it. I mean, I took him even without that, and it turns out he had it in him all along. Oh, my God. That's like cherry on top, you know? And it's like, oh, my gosh. I mean, he started off with a Yamaha, and that was okay, but we got a beautiful Harley sitting in our garage right now. And, you know, but, I mean, it's like, again, but when I first got what I wanted, I wasn't sure I wanted it. He was, like, being honest with me about things like, whoa, okay? And I had put that on my list that I wanted an honest man, but dang. I mean, there were some things that were just almost seemed outright rude to me, you know. Like, why is your license expired? Well, back when I was with him, you know, I didn't have insurance, and they want you to have insurance, and I didn't have the registration tags, which I don't understand why they give me a ticket for not having the registration tags. If I had the money for the ticket, I'd have bought the tag, you know. I mean, but it's like, again, I had some stuff that wasn't cleaned up, even at this point, and what he says to me is, you know what, look, he said, it's like you're walking around with this big pink elephant in your living room. You're walking around it, over it, every single day. He said, and frankly, if you can ignore that, I'm not sure what else you could ignore. My normal reaction to that in the past would have been, I don't know who you think you are. But you ain't going to talk to me that way. You just get on up and get on out of here. And what ended up happening was I went, oh, no, I know, I know. And I went and did something about it. I knew I owed, I called. Turns out you can call them. It's kind of cool. They don't come and rush you like right away or anything. You call them. They told me how much I owed, $1,200, and somehow with a hair of help from him. But I had the majority of it where it's like I got all the money together and I went down, and I didn't know if they were going to arrest me or what, but I went in there and I said, I'm here to pay my thing. And she goes, oh, are you going to pay the full $1,200 or just 10%? Ten percent. No, my gosh, I can't do that. Here, just take it now, you know. I had no idea. They'll work with you. I mean, I didn't know. I just didn't know, right? I'm stupid. It's like, again, total denial. If I don't look, it's not there. You know, and so, I mean, that was our journey, and we couldn't have sex for the first 6 months, which was fine. I was like, fine, that's great. She said, but that includes no holding hands and no kissing. No kissy-kissy, no nothing at all. Don't touch him. Well, what if he's at a meeting? You know I'm a hugger. I hug everybody. What, I can't hug him too? And she said, okay, fine, but you're not allowed to change your home group. Because we weren't at the same home group at the time. And I was like, wow. Wow. And I was mad. Like a year before, I'm on my belly groveling. I don't care what you have to do. My life is horrible and I can't ever do this again. I'll do whatever you tell me to do. I swear I will. What? You want me to do what? No holding hands that. And we didn't. And he didn't even try. She said, if he does, he's not showing you respect. So don't think, oh yeah, he satisfied me. You know, no matter what I said, oh, I'm so fine. Mm-mm. That is absolute and utter disrespect. It just is. And when you can't do any of that, he said, I'm not going to a movie with you because, God forbid, I accidentally put my arm around you. He said, so I ain't going nowhere where I got to sit like real close to you or nothing. So, you know, maybe after we can hold hands or something, we'll go to the movies. And so what is there to do? Talk. I mean, oh, my Lord. Everything we did, we talked. We talked and we talked and we sat on the couch. We figured out shortly that one needed to be on the couch and then in a chair, because if it was both on the couch, I mean, there would be like this moment where all I want to do is reach over and put my hand there. That's all I wanted to do. Just put my hand just right on his thigh. Just right. That's it. Just sense of ease and comfort, right? I mean, And we both knew it was awkward, and we both knew, oh, my gosh. In fact, Doug said to me, he goes, look, he said, I've talked to my sponsor, and I'm willing to do this, but I'm telling you, after 6 months, something's happening. I got enough friends. I ain't looking for no more, so 6 months, something's going to happen. And something happened. And even with everything that we did in following direction, and let me tell you something, we've been, like this past April was 15 years married and, you know, over 16 together, and I've not learned anything of huge significance about my husband since the first 3 months that I dated him. In 16 years, I've not learned anything of significance about him that I didn't learn in the first 3 months. I didn't know how to have conversations like that. What's your principles? What do you believe in? What's important to you? What about disciplined children? Do you want any children? If so, what's okay with you? What about your parents? If something ever happens to one of them, is it okay if they come live with us? Is that okay with you or not? I mean, just over and over, and that came from sponsorship. It didn't come because all of a sudden I'm thinking something original. It was through sponsorship, you know, and it doesn't matter how I feel about you. If we've got some big areas that we just are not on the same page with, and it is just not going to work. And we may can pull it off, but when that moment and that time comes where that one's going to come to light and come to shine, I can't tell you the people I have watched over and over again. And even with all of that, we still found our marriage in trouble. I'd gotten pregnant with Rachel, and right after I had her, he had been building up some resentments. And really, I know today that the source of his resentment was God. We had been trying to get pregnant, and we weren't, and then we finally were. Thought that was the answer, but you know, once you've kind of filled up the checklist, it's, you know, you just can't hardly uncheck it because it's just there now. And we did. We ended up separated for 6 months, and we were co-hosting the hospitality room at the state convention. And as it kept getting closer, I kept telling my sponsor, I'm telling you right now, I can't work with that man in the hospitality room. There's like a bed like in the other room, and I can't do this. I mean, I'm trying to be good, but I ain't that good. And, you know, here's the thing, though. We were acting with principles. People asked us constantly when they saw us at meetings, are you back together? There was tons of people in my area, DFW area, didn't even know we were separated because we weren't out in the groups talking about it. We weren't talking bad about each other. We weren't talking anything about it except to our sponsors and doing what we needed to do. By the time that hospitality room came, because she kept saying, honey, the hard work's in the head of time, you know, getting all the stuff lined up for it. She said, we'll figure it out when it gets here. And you know what? By the time it got there, we just worked it because that's what you asked of us. We just did. And it was the Monday after we served you that I said to him, have you not given any thought to maybe what we can do to keep this marriage together? And he said, I can't believe you asked me that tonight. And that Thursday he moved back in, and he's been there ever since. And, you know, with all of the fuss that I've made and my fussiness at God as far as moving us here to Georgia, and my gosh, are you kidding me? My grandbaby and my 84-year-old mom still living in the house. And, God, what the heck are you doing? I never saw myself leaving there. And yet, you know, we've talked a lot over the last little while, and it's like, I would not trade this. If something was to happen that I went back to Texas tomorrow, I would not trade the gifts that have been given here. The gifts in our relationship, we had gotten a little too comfortable. He had his people, I had my people, and I think sometimes we talk more to our people than we did to each other about some things. And I'm so grateful. That grandbaby of mine, I'm her Momo. I have a little message on my thing. Hi, Momo, you didn't answer. She called me Sunday. You didn't answer. I'm going to try you again a minute. You know, I was like, when she came to see me the first time here, she looked out back and went, where's your pool, Momo? I had a pool in Texas. She's like, what the heck? Why didn't you bring it? You know, and yet it's like, I have so many gifts in my life. So many that I can't even tell you. And I would be, I mean, this is, I'm so glad. I can't tell you how, I told Jerry before the meeting, I'm like, gosh, I'm glad the person that couldn't make it was on Friday, because I am like so done here in just a second. Oh, thank you, Lord. And, but there's this story in the back of our book, and I'm a big 164-page gal. I mean, I you know, that's where the crux is of our program and steps, and oh, it's so important. But holy cow, if you're not sure that you relate or you're having trouble finding someone to relate to, pull our book out and start reading the stories in the back. I bet, I bet you'll find one that looks kind of similar to you. But the keys to the kingdom is one of my favorite stories. And at the very end of that story, it says, the last X amount of years of my life have been rich and meaningful. I have had my share of problems, heartaches, and disappointments, because that is life. But I have also known a great deal of joy and a peace that is the handmaiden of an inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends. Thank you. Thank you. And with my AA friends, an unusual quality of fellowship. For to these people, I am truly related. First through mutual pain and despair, and later through mutual objectives and newfound faith and hope. And as the years go by, working together, sharing our experiences with one another, and also sharing a mutual trust, understanding, and love without strings, without obligation, we acquire relationships that are unique and priceless. There is no more aloneness so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach it. That ache is gone and need never to return. Now there is a sense of belonging, of being wanted and needed and loved. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we have been given the keys to the kingdom. Thank you.